Welcome to episode 132 of the Pivotal Podcast. If you're new to the podcast, this is where we talk about behaviour management, safeguarding, and every possible other different aspect of teaching and learning in these free weekly episodes. I'll do a reminder at the end of how to get involved yourself with the podcast, but everything you need to know is always at pivotalpodcast.com/get involved. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan. This week, Ollie managed to speak to David Whittaker, and here's that conversation. Without any further ado.
Hello, everyone. Yes, it's Ollie Frith in place of Paul Dix. He's up to busier and more exciting things. Well, I don't know about more exciting because today we've got a really fantastic guest on, a guest who we've had many, many, many people, including friend of the podcast, Hal Roberts, contacting us saying, do you know what, you've got to get this guy on. Today I'm speaking to Dave Whittaker, who is the executive head at Springwell Academy, Special Academy in Barnsley. He's been there about 8 years, but he's also worked as a senior leader in a large secondary school. He's been responsible for inclusion, special educational needs. He's on the executive committees for the Yorkshire and Humber PRU and special school heads, and is the tutor for the National College on the Special School Leaders Programme. It's my great pleasure to welcome you, Dave Whittaker, to the podcast. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Ollie, and thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm going to go straight into the first question because I've been online and had a look at the sort of things that you're doing, and you talk quite a lot about unconditional positive regard for students. Let's start off with you just giving us a really clear idea of what does an unconditional positive regard for students look like in a school.
I think it's probably worth your listeners sort of understanding that this is something that I've made up. It's not something that that's some sort of genius thing that's come from Springwell. It's something that we've nicked from the sort of counselling and therapeutic background and a guy called Kyle Rogers. And it really is what it is. What it looks like in schools is more of a metaphor, really, for an ethos and a set of values, I think, than something that's just a bunch of words. And what I like to think is that unconditional positive regard is something that you can feel and you can see, and it's just part of the whole school atmosphere and values and ethos as you walk around the building. It's this concept of providing sort of an authentic approach to what you do, where you actually truly believe in the children, and they can spit in your face today, but you're okay with them tomorrow.
Yeah, that's really key, isn't it? It seems like such a simple, obvious answer, doesn't it? A sort of response to, why wouldn't you be authentic with your students and unconditional? I mean, that's such a lovely idea that seems basic, but actually is a complete turnaround, isn't it, from what some schools are doing?
Yeah, and I think what happens is that people sort of pay lip service to their sort of value statements and vision, and you can go on a school website, any school website in the country, and you'll find that particular school is the most inclusive and school in the world. They provide care for everybody, and all their value statements are there, aren't they? And they're there on the website, but are they there in reality, and are they authentic, and does it work every single day in school? And that, I challenge that sometimes.
That's really interesting, isn't it, when we talk about authenticity and, lip service and sort of, are we doing what we say? And a lot of adults sort of, do as I say, not as I do. And are we modelling our expectations, modelling what we want? Can you just give me a little bit, you mentioned sort of authenticity and something authentic. Go into, because that's something else you talk about, isn't it, authentic care. So can you sort of give us a bit of detail about that?
Yeah, I mean, I use the term authentic care a lot, and it's one of my sort of, I use it a lot with the staff, and we talk about it, and we use it when we address our values within the school. We talk about providing authentic care. But that's something, again, that came about because I had some visitors, some other head teachers visited the school, maybe going back maybe 4 years now, and they came and did an inquiry, and they went around the school, and then when we were going through this inquiry, we were looking at the relationships between adults and children. And they coined the phrase authentic care. And they said to me, what we've seen in your school today is authentic care. And I loved it. And I thought, we'll run with that. Because what they said, there was a genuineness about what the staff do in that interaction. And what we then took and sort of created a statement, and I'll sort of say that for you now, because this is another thing that I use. The adults believe in the children, and the children believe they believe in them. Yeah. And you've sort of got to say it twice or think about it, because it's about that two-way relationship. You know what, these kids that we work with here, they see through you if you're fake.
Yeah, for sure. You're absolutely right, aren't you? Yeah, in terms of adults, I think there's a lot of adults that say, but I do care about you. But their responses, their actions, their all the other things just proves otherwise, doesn't it? And like you said, the children just see straight through it.
That's right. And also then you've got that problem with, they might say they've got unconditional positive regard. They might say that they've got authentic care, but until they tell you to F off, and then when they tell you to F off, they want you excluded. You know, they want the kid excluded. So, where's the fine line, isn't it?
I will give you my positive regard unconditionally with these conditions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, on my terms.
Okay, so, Dave, look, you know, we talk a lot, and a lot of our listeners sort of really know the pivotal philosophies that are sort of built upon kindness and nurture and sort of restoration. So let's get your take on punishment. Tell me, what is wrong with punishing them?
Well, there's a couple of things, really. First of all, the children that I work with have all had every single punishment that you could ever throw at them, and it's not worked. So why would we just continue punishing them? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they clearly don't work anyway for the majority of children. And you know, people could sit there, they can be listening and say, what's he talking about? He's some sort of tree hugger. But it's not like that at all. I'd really like your listeners to revisit the film Kez. And there's a great clip in the film Kez where the head teacher is lining the boys up in his office ready to cane them. I don't know whether you remember that scene.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
But he's saying same old, same faces.
Same old.
And he says, it doesn't matter how many times I cane you, you still go out and smoke. And then what I do is I just have to cane you again. And then you go out and smoke. And you know what? Even when we could physically beat children, it didn't work.
Yeah.
So now excluding them for a day, and so they can play on their Xbox for the day, or giving them a detention, it clearly doesn't work, because when we used to be able to whip them with a stick, they still went off and did it. And what I see is children that just factor punishment into their lives. If they get a detention twice a week, they just factor it in. And you go and look at the detention data in a secondary school and look at the repeat offenders. You know, I know that there are some children, don't get me wrong, there are some children, if you punish them, they'll never do it again. Yeah. That's mainly to do with the backgrounds, it's mainly to do with their upbringing, it's mainly to do with the fact that the parents will probably kick off at them as well. But if you take that out, what you've actually got is same old faces, same old faces.
Yeah, it's those lines, isn't it? I suppose I would ask any of our listeners to just think about, have you ever said to a learner, how many times do I have to say this to you? It's that line, isn't it? It's like, kind of just reflect on, if you're saying that, then you're almost giving yourself the answer that you respond, whatever you're doing isn't working. It's not the broken learner. It's the broken punishment or the broken system. Let's talk. Do you think mainstream schools exclude too many children?
I do. I absolutely do. But I also have a massive sympathy for the demands of heads in mainstream schools when they're having to try and meet accountability measures. The bottom line is, at the moment, is the accountability and the inclusion agendas don't match. So for schools with a pressure attached to them to go further up the league tables for their progress 8 measures, attainment 8, call it what you like, it's impacted if they are inclusive. So what tends to happen is, if you want fast track school improvement, the easiest way to do fast track school improvement is actually get rid of a number of kids and change your cohort. And what really bothers me at the moment is that fast track school improvement is held in high regard. But if you dig below the surface, what you find is, you find that there's actually a cohort change. So these community schools that are kicking kids out left, right and centre, and thousands of days fixed term exclusions, what's happening is they're actually changing the cohort, so therefore they're not actually serving the communities where they are. You can do it, and it's the easiest way to do it. So, but I actually feel sorry for the head teachers. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a head teacher bashing. I see and feel the strain. And actually, what they've got to be is they've got to be brave, because it's a difficult
pressure to fight against, isn't it?
Very, particularly if the school down the road is doing it, because then there starts to be, if you can't beat them, join them sort of approach. What they need to do is they need to be brave enough to take on Ofsted, if you like, and that's hard. That's a tough gig.
Yeah, Yeah, that's really tough. So I mean, you know, that's it's I mean, that's great advice, isn't it? Be brave, and it's easy said. And there'll be a lot of listeners going, "Well, yeah, I want to be, but I don't feel I can yet, or given the circumstances, you know, there's too many pressures." But you know, let's bring it back to the teachers in the classroom, because let's face it, you know, head teachers have got difficult decisions to make. But those decisions are, I think, are exacerbated by the pressure from teachers internally, aren't they, as well? So,
oh yeah, it all goes down through the system, of course it does. It's not just the pressure the heads are under, it's the pressure every single classroom teacher is under to get their children through the best possible GCSE scores, SAT scores, yeah. Whatever it might be.
So in terms of advice that you give teachers on a regular basis, in much the same way of, you know, how many times do I have to say this to you? What's the repeated advice that you keep giving to teachers that you keep wanting to say, look, think like this, follow this idea?
Yeah, I think one of the advantages I have working in a specialist setting is that I'm allowed to give teachers time. So I would say that I ask teachers to have patience, to work at the relationships that they have with the children, get to know the children really, really well, but then plan really well and be organised. And what you can't do when you're working with children with challenging behaviours is leave things to chance.
Yeah.
Because if you leave it to chance, then it's going to come back and bite you. And what we try to do is support our teachers to turn them into specialists, and don't expect them to be specialists on day one. So they're not going to get sacked after the first few weeks if they can't control the class properly. What we do is we help them and support them to work with their class.
I think that's an interesting thing about sort of, you know, the whole planning thing, isn't it? I think, you know, sort of meet some teachers that sort of their planning starts when the learners are sat listening, ready to learn, and ends when the bell goes and the lesson finishes and students leave the classroom. And I think, yeah, actually we kind of need to build sort of what comes before that and what comes after that into the planning of how am I going to connect and engage and enthuse and inspire and empathise. So I think, yeah, that organisation and not leaving things to chance is really, really key.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, we talk about a lot of the learners you work with, especially, and a lot of the learners that are going through that, the same old names, you know, it's not a coincidence that we also talk about their emotional needs or their emotional behavioural challenges. And I think there is a link, isn't there, between the sort of the same old names. So I mean, if we're talking about working with teachers and adults who are connecting to these type of learners, I mean, how do we best prepare these teachers to work with these specific children who have these emotional and behavioural difficulties?
I think it's a combination of all sorts of things, really, because what you have got to do is there's got to be an obvious element of formal training around special educational needs, around the specific disorders, disabilities, and conditions. And I think that you have to understand them and know them really well. And that's just a work in progress. You work at that, and you know, you can read a book, but at the same time, you actually work with these children, and you're in there up to your neck in it. And so that's your sort of formal training. I think the teachers who work right across the board need good mentoring. They need to work with good people, and they need lots of support and reassurance from those people. Because what I say to the teachers here is, it's okay to fail, and it's okay to get it wrong, and if you get it wrong and then learn from it, it's fine.
And
I think that just generally in our profession, that's what we should look to do, because these children are unrelentless. And they can grind you down, can't they? You know, and you have to be you have to have that resilience and learn that resilience, and you can only get that with reassurance that it's okay to get it wrong.
Yeah, you got to feel that support exists, and it's the same as we. You know, I suppose it's the same thing that you say to your learners. They've got to know that you're there, and know that you believe in them, and know that you're not going to give up on them. And I suppose your staff have to feel the same, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
So on that note, then, you know, let's talk about that. I mean, how do you look after the well-being of your staff? Where you sort of really give them that support that they can give that commitment to their learners that you require them to.
Well, I'd hope that the staff know and understand that they're valued, and I sort of try to make that really, really clear to them. And what we do is we actually have at my school, we actually have a fairly significant financial investment into the staff. In various ways, you know, staff get paid more to work here. So if you fancy a job at Springwell, then you can get more money. If any, so keep an eye out for the adverts.
Yeah.
Little pitch there, but no. In all seriousness, they do get that little bit of extra money because they're expected to go the extra mile. Yeah. And we also have a staff wellbeing group, so they get together to talk about things that they can do to support each other and make life a little bit easier. We invest money in that staff wellbeing group, so any of the money that sort of I earn when I'm out and about doing bits and pieces, I put that into a pot at school, which is a sort of wellbeing pot. So yeah, it means we can fund things without it coming out of the children's money. Yeah. So we fund staff socials, we do after school clubs for staff, fitness classes, art classes, we've got a cycling class that runs on a weekend. We chuck money into the staff socials so that the staff can go out and do it on the cheap. We make sure that when staff are off, they get some flowers. We invest massively in CPD so that people can get high quality training when they come and work for us. We're just developing a wellbeing buddy system at the moment. We've put 30 members of staff through a basic counselling course, and they're hopefully going to then convert that into being staff wellbeing buddies, so that there's informal supervision. We give the staff free lunches, free breakfasts, tea and coffee throughout the day.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because it feels like it's the small stuff that collectively makes a huge difference. I mean, a few months ago, we had Catherine Lovewell on talking about staff wellbeing and how we've got to value that.
Yeah,
I'm really understanding the needs of the staff. You know, so it's not just one directional, and we're just talking about what support we're putting in for the learners, and you know, what we're doing, and what changes, and what interventions. But we're actually looking holistically at everyone that we're working with.
Well, they're your biggest resource, aren't they? You know, the most expensive and valuable resource.
Yeah.
In this setting, because relationships are so vital. You know, if your staff aren't there, your relationships have gone.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you mentioned going the extra mile and expecting staff to, you know, we pay them a little bit more so they go the extra mile. Do you think going the extra mile is ever a sort of time where it's going too far?
Well, I suppose it's about finding a balance. It's all about finding a balance. And for me, you create a culture where the staff understand what needs to be done. So our children walk in here on a morning, and the staff have to be with them until the second they walk out of the door. We don't even have a staff room. So that there isn't, they don't get the downtime, the formal downtime that is that you might associate with other schools. Yeah. But what we do allow is we allow a flexibility for things like downtime breaks, 10 minutes here. I'm convinced that the staff see that as a give and take model. And that's why we invest in staff wellbeing. When does going the extra mile become too far? Difficult one to answer that. But I suppose you as a professional, we have to make a judgment call when we think we're pushing staff too far and it's time to back off. I'd hope that I could do that, and I can see that.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you've talked about sort of, you know, a massive investment in staff and, you know, I suppose you could see that as an intervention. But well, I suppose our listeners would be really interested to know the work that you're doing, in your school. So talk about the interventions that you put in place for the learners. What do you invest most money in? And also, what do you think, you know, what works best for your learners? And I suppose also, how do you know what works best?
Well, I just mentioned staff, and the obvious one is what you need is you need great staff. And when you've got your great staff, both teaching and support staff, don't get me wrong, we're not just talking about teachers here. And once you've got those great staff, you need to support them in their professional development. So we, as I said to you before, we spend a lot of money and a lot of time on CPD. But then we've actually got to, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, if you take the children that we've got here, really vulnerable backgrounds, really low starting points, reading, you know, we need to get them reading. So we have had a massive focus on reading interventions and just becoming a school that reads, and children who are confident to read, are happy to read. Everybody reads every single day in this school, every kid. And what happens when you talk about then results, that impacts on right across the board on everything. Because what you've got is you've got kids reading. If they can read, they can do all the stuff.
Yeah.
And so what we do is we do that, and then alongside that, we concentrate on trying to create great teachers doing great stuff in the classrooms, and that's just developing great pedagogy.
The reading's a huge one, isn't it? There's a tendency, isn't there, for some schools to think, okay, well, the more that we can get them reading, the better their reading will become. And I think, okay, that simplistic attitude sort of forgets the idea of establishing a love of reading, which kind of has to come first, doesn't it?
Yeah, and all that, and a lot of that's to do with role modelling. It's the way that you do it with the children. It's the way you establish a reading culture within the school. And it's a bigger picture, isn't it? As you just said, than just insisting that a kid sits down and reads. So it's a lot more to it.
Okay, so the sort of learners that you work with, for some of them, they are the learners that could be considered that other adults have given up on. Why work with the children who other adults have said, I've tried everything with that child and it hasn't worked. That's it. I've failed. What rewards is there in the work that you do with these specific learners?
Well, one of the things I sort of quite often say to staff, on that first morning in September when you're trying to sort of rally the staff and say, there's a year ahead and, it's great working at Springwell. What I talk about is the influence that they have on vulnerable children's lives and we as an organisation. And one of the things I noticed in a comparison between working in a mainstream school and working in a specialist provision, particularly around vulnerable children with linked to behaviour, is that we, as adults, we have such an influence on the lives of these children that in many cases it's more important and more valuable than their own parents. In a sense that we are the people they rely on, and we are the people that are there to really, really nurture them and bring them on. That is massively rewarding and massively satisfying.
Yeah.
And that sort of sells it to me, because I noticed that, I noticed in a mainstream school, you can be influential. And you can have kids who think you're great as a teacher, but the bottom line is they go home to mum and dad at the end of the day, and the mum and dad come first. We've got kids who cry at the end of the summer term because they don't want to go and out have 6 weeks at home.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to be in school because that's where they're loved. You can't put a price on that.
You can't. I mean, that's, and there'll be definitely many listeners nodding their heads, recognising that's why they do what they do. Dave, look, we've come to very near the end now, but we've got a question that we ask every single one of our podcast interviews. So just in a few words, what's the best thing you've ever learnt from a child?
Humility, humbleness. When you understand the lives of some of these children, then you learn to never to take anything for granted. And you also learn that life's not fair. And if you can put a little bit back and do your own little bit to make it a little bit fairer, then that's what you should do, really.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. And what a lovely note to end a fantastic interview on. Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've taken up a lot of your time, but I could carry this on for hours. But thank you so much from me, from Pivotal. It's been an absolute joy talking to you.
Cheers, Ollie. Thank you very much.
If the listeners want to get in touch with you, Dave, I'm sure they might have sort of just comments, questions, ideas. Are you on Twitter? You have a contact email address?
Yeah, Twitter's as a starting point. Twitter's always the best thing to do. So it's at DaveWhittaker246 on Twitter. And if you track me down on Twitter, and if you want anything at all, I'll sort of contact you via Twitter, and then I can send you my email address and things like that. And people are quite welcome to come and visit Springwell when we can fit them in.
There we go. What a fantastic offer, Dave. I'm sure we'll put your Twitter handle on the show notes. But there's an offer. If they can fit you in, then Springwell will welcome your visits. So there we go, listeners. Thank you again, David, and look forward to speaking to you soon.
Cheers, Holly. Thank
you. Cheers. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That was a truly inspirational conversation. So many thanks to Ollie and David. Check out the show notes for this episode at pivotalpodcast.com/132 for David's contact details, and also for details of the brand new free Pivotal app for your Apple or Android device. You can listen to the podcast through that or subscribe any other way you like. And also don't forget about the new initiative, which has the hashtag #HotChocFry for Hot Choc Friday. As Paul put it, it's simple. Get a gift pack for your head teacher from Pivotal, choose a learner you want to recognise for going above and beyond, share a hot chocolate with them on a Friday, and tweet a picture. For more information and how to get hold of your gift pack, just tweet to @PivotalPaul. There are already some great photos of head teachers sharing a chocolate with those special learners. So do get involved yourself with that. Finally, if you're able to leave a review or rating for the Pivotal Podcast in iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app, that would be wonderful. And I look forward to seeing you next week.